Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Death is not the end when it comes to the lucrative world of literary estates. The growth of streaming services and the demand for audiobooks means posthumous deals can in fact be very lucrative. For more on this, I'm joined by Adam Maguire now from the RTE Business Desk. Hello, Adam.
How are you?
Now, the interest around authors' estates has changed an awful lot in recent years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, probably once would have been the case that managing an author's estate was about being a custodian. You know, you just kind of oversee the body of work until it falls out of copyright. But it's now an incredibly complex and potentially incredibly lucrative industry. There's multiple companies now that exist purely to acquire and manage intellectual property of dead authors, in large part because we also have many, many media companies and entertainment companies trying to get their hands on the associated rights.
And content. They want the content.
Exactly. And I think the turning point is the early 2000s, because if you think back to that, we had the Lord of the Rings films started and then the Harry Potter films, both in 2001, the first of those came out, and they made an absolute fortune at the box office. I think when you add up the 7 Harry Potters and the 3 Lord of the Rings films, it's something like 10 billion at the global box office.
Well, there you go. That explains everything.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, you get your merchandising and your clothing and all the other spin-off kind of stuff. You know, studios realize if you get your hands on the right set of rights, you don't just get one box office hit, you get multiple, and you get all of these other revenue streams. You can create a universe, you can have, you know, theme park rides and everything. So you see this scramble then for book rights, and, you know, some of the more modern series like Phil Pullman's His Dark Materials, Owen Colfer's Artemis Fowl, and then also digging through the archives for the older ones that maybe weren't fully exploited. So like the Narnia series, C.S. Lewis's Narnia books were made into films around that time too. And then the streamers arrive on the scene in kind of the, you know, 2008, I think it was when Netflix kind of comes along, and they're desperate for, as you say, content. They have lots of venture capital and tech money. And so the competition for these book rights and series and characters and even the entire body of an author's work really heats up. So you very quickly have authors and their estates getting big money offers to hand over rights, which could be very lucrative. And those estates also seeing the potential that if you have a big hit film or TV show, there's a renewed interest in the books then. So the book sales take off again. So it's potentially, you know, lucrative on the double if you own the rights to these things.
You can drag the you-know-what out of it if you get it right.
Absolutely, and they're trying,
There's a really interesting story, though, isn't there, behind Ian Fleming, who was very much ahead of the curve on all this.
He really was, yeah. He optioned the rights to his existing and future James Bond books in 1954, something that is quite common now to do that with a character, but back then it was pretty much unheard of. And bear in mind, at the time, he only had 2 Bond books out. He was working on more, obviously. And the deal actually excluded the first book, which was Casino Royale, which he'd sold the rights to separately. That's why there's a separate old version of Casino Royale outside of the, you know, James Bond, Sean Connery and all that. That is Peter Sellers as Bond, Orson Welles as a Chiffre, which was kind of a satire that was done separately. But it was Albert Broccoli and Harry Zaltzman who bought up the rights to the other Fleming works. They set up Eon Productions and they go on to develop what has now become an iconic film franchise. Separate to that, though, then, Fleming also did a deal relating to the actual books. So shortly before he died, he was playing golf with an old Eton school friend, John Middleton Campbell, and he was complaining about taxes, which were really high at the time for authors, and particularly the hefty taxes his family would have to pay after he died and the money that the books continued to make. Campbell was the chair of a company called Booker McConnell, which at the time was heavily dealing in sugar and shipping. And he suggested that as a favour, he'd take a majority stake in Gildrose Productions, which was Fleming's company. They would then structure it in such a way that the tax burden would be much lower. They'd also be able to manage the admin, you know, dealing with translation rights and all that kind of stuff. And so it'd be much easier for Fleming and his family. That ended up being such a success for Booker McConnell that they established an entire business around books and book rights. They went on to sponsor a major literary prize, which is where we get the Booker Prize from
today. Extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's
sugar
all because
company.
Of all the sugar company, and because Ian Fleming was moaning over golf about his tax burden. The Fleming family then eventually took full control of the books again. It's now under Ian Fleming Productions. And, you know, not just managing the work that he did up until his death in 64, they've been very active in growing the Bond universe. They've brought new authors in to write new series. So there's some young Bond books, the spin-off books around Moneypenny and Felix Leiter, graphic novels. They say initially they were doing that because they wanted to stave off kind of copycats who are trying to steal the legacy of Bond. Today, though, there's more than twice as many official Bond books written by other authors than there are books that were written by Ian Fleming originally as well. So 36, I think, Bond books in total. He wrote about 12.
So what about the film rights then?
Yeah, well, they remain remained in the control of the Broccoli family until quite recently. Saltzman sold his stake in Bond to Universal Artists, which in turn was acquired by MGM. But through all of this, the Broccoli family retained full creative control of the series. Albert's daughter, Barbara Broccoli, took over during the Brosnan years, and ultimately she was responsible for taking the darker, grittier turn with Daniel Craig post Austin Powers, when they needed to kind of get rid of kind of some of the sillier stuff. The Broccolis continued to have creative control then when Amazon bought MGM for $8.5 billion. You know, even though Bond was kind of seen as the jewel in the crown for Amazon and acquiring this universe, they didn't have control over it. The Broccoli still had final say, and apparently led to quite a lot of tension between the two. That then led to Amazon taking the checkbook out again, reportedly paying another $1 billion directly to the Broccolis to get the full control over it. They still have a stake, they still get some money out of it, but now Amazon have full creative control, and the expectation is we're going to see more movies, spin-offs, TV shows, prequels, all that kind of stuff starting to pop up on Amazon Prime in the near future.
But the Flemings also get a bit of this too.
The Flemings still get money from the film rights too, yeah, and from the books as well, so they're doing quite well.
So Ian Fleming, from all of this, we can see that he embraced film adaptations, but his friend, Roald Dahl, did not.
Yeah, there weren't too many films based on Roald Dahl, actually, I found it recently, but I say Roald Dahl as well. His work, while he's still alive, he was quite critical of most of it, though. Willy Wonka.
Critical of me now, too, mispronouncing his name.
Well, I think most people say Roald Dahl, and I do as well, but yeah, it's Roald, it's a Norwegian name. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, probably one of the best known film adaptations. He thought the music was saccharine, sappy, and sentimental. He hated the changes made to the story, like the addition of the Slugworth subplot, or the way it made more about Willy Wonka than Charlie. It may be in part because he wanted Spike Milligan to be Willy Wonka rather than Gene Wilder, so maybe he just kind of had it in his craw. He also, though, hated the 1990 version of The Witches, saying it was utterly appalling. He also took issue with the fact that the boy gets turned back into a human at the end rather than being kept a mouse and dying at a young age, which is what happens in the book.
Very scary, that film.
Yeah, it is, and you know, but he loved his dark and scary kind of stories. You'd think he might have a bit more sympathy, though, for kind of film adaptations and the changes you need to make, because he would have done some. He actually did Ian Fleming books. He did the screenplay for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and for You Only Live Twice. Roald Dahl did the screenplay, though. So you'd think he'd appreciate that you have to make changes for film. But anyway, he obviously was very particular about how his work should be handled.
He should have just done it himself.
He probably should have, yeah. But, you know, it doesn't seem like his family, though, are quite as discerning. He probably would have hated the Danny DeVito Matilda, which came out in the late 90s. A number of left turns book, also set in the US. Great film, though, but I don't think he would have liked it. He probably would have hated Wonka and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory prequel. You know, has a whole backstory that he didn't sanction. It has songs as well by Neil Hannon. Great songs, but he probably would have thought they were sappy as well. And of course, you have Matilda the Musical, which also had songs. He probably would have hated that, although it was a bit more faithful to the original book, so he might have forgiven that a little bit. But that all set the stage anyway for a deal that the Dallas State did with Netflix, that Matilda the Musical one. 4 years ago, they paid $700 million to acquire the entire Dahl estate. That gives them the rights to shows, films, games, and the books as well. Last month they released a film based on The Twits. Again, very loosely based on it. Last year, they brought out a continuation novel, a sequel to The Twits, which obviously wasn't written by Roald Dahl, but it's an official version of it, which is based on the original license from the 1980s book.
The Twits, the movie, didn't go down too well in my house. Was it watched in your house yet?
It hasn't been watched in my house. Of what I've seen of it, it seems very, very little resemblance to the original books.
Yeah, and the book is such a joy.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
The boys getting their trousers stuck to the tree.
What
about Dr. Seuss?
Yeah, Theodore Seuss Geisel, Dr. Seuss, he's better known. When he was alive, he made a number of TV specials, but didn't really make any movies based on his work, probably due to the fact he did write one feature film, The 50,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which was a complete failure, so it probably scared him off doing more. He also shied away from merchandise and exploiting the character any other way. But 2 years after his death in 91, his wife, Audrey Geisel, set up Dr. Seuss Entertainment as a vehicle for managing the estate. She started farming out licenses, including a theme park ride at Universal Studios. She gave the rights to Cat in the Hat to Steven Spielberg, but then took them back because he wasn't quite getting it right. And she sparked a massive bidding war for film rights for studios. The LA Times reported that people had to offer $3 million to meet her.
To meet Audrey
to talk about film rights. In the end, Universal paid $5 million up front for the Grinch, and they gave her a cut. She also had a lot of creative control. Jim Carrey had to pretty much audition for her to get the part. But in the end, it was an absolute smash hit. then The Cat in the Hat with Mike Myers came out, which was a complete flop. And apparently it put her off. She won't or wouldn't sanction live action versions anymore. It had to be cartoons. And we've had a number of animated adaptations, probably not done too well, except for The Grinch, the cartoon, which was a huge hit as well. There is a new Cat in the Hat movie coming out next year. And of course, people will know, even last Christmas, the amount of Dr. Seuss and particularly Grinch-related merchandise that's out there
huge
now is
everywhere.
Unbelievable. So yeah, huge money being made there.
Now, a quick word about Agatha Christie then.
Yeah, and by the time she died in 76, there hadn't been an awful lot of her work exploited. There was a version of Murder the Orient Express, which was led by Albert Finney, which did quite well. But again, she was very clever in managing her estate. She had set up Agatha Christie Limited in the 50s, in part because of the tax burden, the same thing Ian Fleming was dealing with. She also went on to sell a majority stake to the same company, to Booker McConnell. And that changed hands a few times. It's now in the hands of an American media company, RLJ Entertainment. They now have rights to 66 novels, 166 short stories, Poirot, Miss Marple, of course, being a big part of that. And it still exists. You can go onto the website and you can, you know, get in touch with them if you have any ideas for a film or a TV show. Lots of foreign versions of them as well, and they've published lots of continuation novels of Poirot and Miss Marple. The former CEO Matthew Pritchard said it's a good way to keep people interested in the back catalogue, and yeah, we've also seen obviously the Kenneth Branagh films that have come out recently as well. So still a lot of money being made by the Agatha Christie
to
estate.
Exploit
yeah.
there lots, in what yeah. Agatha Christie has left behind. Adam, thank you so much. We will take a quick break before the news.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.